Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Throughout the world, agricultural workers have been dispossessed of their lands, but now they are fighting back. We examine one campaign in Indonesia and its implications for social and environmental justice. And first, as the climate crisis continues, flooding has become an increasingly serious problem. How do we adapt to this new reality? Do we need to reassess our relationship with water? Can nature inform us about how to minimize these disasters?
Joining us today are two experts, University of Auckland Professor Gary Brierley of Geography and Tim Welch, Senior Lecturer in Architecture and Planning. So welcome to you both. So glad that you could be with us here. I think we should start with both of your arguments about how, through really trying to manage the environment, whether how we've built our cities, Tim, the way you've looked at things, or control our rivers, Gary, the way you've looked at things, we've kind of made ourselves more vulnerable to climate change threats like flooding, and that we're exacerbating the problem because of these things. So maybe we should lay out the problems first. Tim Welch, would you like to start?
Yeah, I mean, coming from an urban planning perspective, so much of what we've done in building our cities has been fighting against nature, and obviously water is one of those big things. So we've tried to figure out ways that we can shed water away from buildings, channel it down our streets, put it into drains, into pipes, and then send it back out into rivers and lakes and out into the sea. And as a result, we've kind of limited ourselves on how well we can handle water. So anytime we see any kind of rainfall or event that's greater or exceeds what we engineered years and years ago, we're suddenly in a lot of trouble. We see flooding, we see damage to property, and we kind of start spinning around wondering, what are we going to do next? How are we going to handle what's inevitably a changing and wetter climate in the future?
How much of it in your work is really about building materials?
Yeah, that's really kind of the crux of it. So we've put a lot of stock in our ability to engineer our way out of every single problem. And that comes right down to the building materials. They're all impervious surfaces. So things that don't drain water, they channel water, they let it flow across surfaces and into drains, but they don't absorb water. And it's the exact opposite of what we see in nature. So we're fighting nature to a big degree. And as a result, we've put ourselves in a precarious situation.
And how widespread is this? Is this like every city on the planet that's kind of dealing with this because we've all sort of tried to build cities in a particular way?
Yeah, the headlines over the last year have been pretty stark. It wasn't just Auckland that had a 1 in 200-year flood, although that 200-year number is probably a lot smaller now as we see wetter climate coming. But there are cities all across the globe that dealt with catastrophic flooding. And every city has essentially been built the same way for years and years and years with lots of impervious surfaces. That's just the way business is done. A number of cities have started to pull back and try to address that and build in new ways. There's no one city that's done a perfect job of it, but there are lots of examples of cities that are trying to address this finally.
One last question for you before we turn to rivers and what we've done to them, kind of in a similar capacity, I think. And that is one of the things I read in your piece, Tim Welch, one of your pieces was about how with this flooding comes sort of this mix of toxic sludge and sewage and yucky stuff. Why is that happening?
Yeah, we have a nice name for it. We just call it CSO or combined sewage overflow. But the reality is every time it rains, not every time, but many times when it rains heavily, our drainage systems, our stormwater systems are overwhelmed and they can flood into and mix with our sewage systems. They all follow essentially pipes underground. They're all linked in some way. And as a result, we get these really disgusting mixes. And then that all goes out to the sea. And as soon as we see big rain happening across the city, we see all our beaches shutting down because of this kind of gross, toxic flow that goes out there. I mean, the reality is we have across New Zealand, 17,000 kilometers of pipes of stormwater, freshwater, and sewage pipes. and they all need to be renewed eventually. We built massively through the 1950s and 60s for an expanding population and cities. And so we're at a situation where we're looking at $180 billion or so of cost to renew all of that infrastructure. And as it ages and we don't pay that bill, we see more and more events where we get these kind of mixes of sewage and stormwater into our waterways.
I suspect it's going on beyond Auckland and New Zealand.
Yeah, it's not just a New Zealand thing, it's a global phenomenon.
Gary Brierley, let's bring you in. You've been talking about how we're trying to confine rivers, and that's exacerbating the problem too, how we've kind of strangled them. How does this make flooding and disaster worse?
It's a different context to the one that Tim's just been talking to, because oftentimes we're now talking about rural settings rather than urban settings, although there are issues in urban settings relating to confining rivers or strangling rivers or burying rivers. When you confine a river, you concentrate its energy. When you concentrate the energy of a river system, you've got the same body of water going down through a smaller space. And when you concentrate that energy of the river reacts and responds in a different way to what it did previously. Just in the same way that Tim was saying a second ago, the way that we planned for these kinds of activities, because this was purposeful, right? We had a total catchment management ethos of trying to regulate and manage our rivers in a particular kind of way. That came about largely in the 1950s and onwards, but we tried to separate the channel from the valley floor, separate the channel from its floodplain, and concentrate the flow in that area so that the mentality or relationships with which we saw rivers was one of flushing systems, systems that just washed that water away, got it offshore, no problem, away we go. But that's not how rivers work. Rivers previously built those floodplains. They were all part of that river system. And we have changed the morphodynamics of those systems, so rivers respond now in different ways. And depending upon how much sediment is moving through that river system, the bed of the river has either incised, it's cut down, or in other instances, the bed of the river has built up, it's aggraded if there's been too much sediment coming from upstream. If you have excess sediment from upstream that used to be spread over the floodplain but is now concentrated in the channel, that means that your capacity of the channel has been reduced, which means that we are manufacturing future disasters in the ways that we're looking after those situations. We are accentuating potential for
because
floods.
Of that energy that's
Because of the concentration of the energy, and if you've had excess sediment load from upstream, right, and the bed of the river has built up, the only option that we now have is to build stop banks higher, right? Artificial levees, build them higher. There's not just issues of environmental damage that comes from these kind of practices. It's also issues of the economic cost and the cost for future generations, what we call path dependencies, right? We're locked into a limited way of doing things now because that's the way that we have been doing things for a long, long time. And I know this is preempting where we're going.
Well, before you preempt, there's
okay.
a phrase that you used in one of your pieces.
Yeah.
That was zombie rivers. And
Mm-hmm.
so I wanted to understand exactly how rivers can become zombies.
We're making them lifeless, right? I mean, that in the sense that if you think of the way that a river system adjusts on its valley floor when it doesn't have stop banks, it dissipates its energy and creates all this diversity of habitat across the valley floor and all this wide range of landforms in pools and riffles and runs and backwater effects and these kinds of things and swamps and wetlands. And all of those diverse habitats drive how a river system works in ecological terms because you've got all those features. You channelize a river, you concentrate its energy, and you diminish that habitat. You take a lot of that habitat away. And so rivers that used to be living systems, they're now concentrated energy systems, which have far less habitat than they previously did have. And so we're creating these zombie lifeless forms that simply the ecosystem processes that fashioned and shaped the way those river systems worked. The rivers had those options taken away from it.
Because you did mention also in that piece about the self-correcting nature of rivers, like it knows what to do in a way, you
Rivers
know?
Are absolutely wonderful. They're just amazing at looking after themselves. The river, if it's a setting where the river self-adjust, what we call an alluvial river. The river creates its own morphology. It decides how many channels it wants to have. It decides what the sinuosity, the wiggliness of those channels is going to be. It decides how it's going to adjust on the valley floor. Rivers are attuned to use their own energy through those different kinds of mechanisms, how they create their own roughness within those
systems.
And that
is both from the water and the biodiversity?
And the sediment that they're moving, right? The ways that sediments are moved and the ways that they manage their roughness, the riparian vegetation or the role of wood. Right within river systems are fundamental to the ways that river systems work. And so when a river hangs together well, all those different parts are in harmony, they're in sync with each other, and we've kind of taken that functionality away.
Yeah, through, you said, narrowing the channels, but also damming.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. So we talk about damming in terms of silencing rivers, and we talk about stop banks as strangling rivers. And so we've modified connectivity relationships, the ways that these systems function.
In fact, I think I remember reading about how you said language really matters in one of your pieces too. And really the language you're choosing does articulate something in a different way than how we traditionally speak about them.
Particularly in context of Aotearoa, I think that language is absolutely pivotal to everything we're talking about now. I'll be honest, I don't even like the language of management, because management is asserting human authority over rivers, as opposed to living generatively with living rivers. And that's the language that I prefer to use in terms of expressing our relationships to rivers and aspirations for what rivers can be.
One other thing that you touched on briefly as you were talking, but I just want to go back to it, is you were talking about rivers that have been sort of buried.
Mm-hmm.
How do you unearth a river that's been buried?
Yeah, there have been numerous daylighting exercises, including here in Auckland City. There are plans or proposals for other ventures in that space here, just in the same way as has happened in other parts of the world. Essentially, you recreating a space that the river has back on the valley floor and taking it out of the pipe. But is a general direction. I approve of things that way. But we're kind of playing God in thinking about what kind of river we want whenever we daylight. We want something still that largely puts the river over there, separate from society, as opposed to merging that river as a part of society and the way we conceptualize it. So there are examples here in Auckland where if we let the river do its own thing, it would become a wetland. And wetlands aren't necessarily the kind of rivers that we want.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we have a river that is in a nice, smooth, meandering channel that behaves itself, then that's the river that is deemed to be acceptable.
Well, now that you said wetland, let's go back to Tim Welch for a minute, because that's one of the ways that these new ways of working with nature, sponge city types of things, is enabling wetlands, right? So can you talk to us about this idea of sponge cities, what they are exactly, and how they work with these water bodies and other kinds of permeable?
Yeah, so sponge city is really just kind of a name that's marketable that was put on the general concept of, you know, not burying nature under a lot of pavement. So a professor named Ko Jung Young, in the year 2000, came up with this term. And broadly, the idea is to move away from what we call gray infrastructure. So paved and engineered solutions, things that, you know, as we were just mentioning, putting streams and rivers in culverts, in cement boxes underground, in paving over every service, in making sure that every driveway has runoff to pipes, et cetera, and moving it over to what we call green systems, right? Letting green space do the work that it's done since before people were around, even that it's well attuned to do. And part of that, so there's kind of two prongs to it. One of it is trying to preserve as much green space and wetland as possible, something we've done pretty poorly and we're still not doing well in the city, in the country, and most cities around the world. We still think that outward expansion of our cities, paving over lots of green space, areas that are prone to flooding, is still a cheap way to develop and provide housing. So we continue to do that, putting ourselves more at risk and reducing the capacity of the natural environment to absorb flood water, rain, etc. And then the other way that we can kind of retrofit, I guess, our cities to make them spongier, more absorbent, is, you know, some of the simple ways we do things is collect the water as it falls as much as we can so that we can reuse it. So rain barrels, things that collect water at your house that is the runoff the roof that can be reused in your gardens. Simple things like not planting lawns, but using more native plants in your garden. They're better at absorbing and holding water. Using the rainwater you collect to water those gardens. Driveways that have permeable surfaces. So if you're going to rebuild your driveway, replace it with gravel or cement strips rather than one big cement block that just creates a river for water to flow into the streets. There's all sorts of other examples of things that are done around the city and in other places. One of the ways we've tried to do things is build green space that can flood. So up in Northcote here in Auckland, there's a great floodable park. It's green space. You can play rugby or football on it. And then during a major event, it basically fills with water, but it's been designed in a way to quickly drain and then return to green space. Hobsonville Point also has special zoning that requires it to build in a lot of things that mitigate flooding. So they have storm bioswales, which are kind of boxes along the way before you get to a storm drain that have natural plantings in them and sand and rock that drains and filters rainwater and captures a lot of that before it goes into the pipes. Everybody has cisterns in their house so they can capture at least 1,000 liters of rain before it goes into the system. And then a lot of the floodplain has been preserved over time. And as a result, during the last year's floods in January, Hobsonville Point didn't flood, really. It mostly stayed dry. Same with Northcote. A lot of those houses did not flood as a result because the park flooded instead. And even a place, you know, closer to the central city in Stonefields development, used to be an old stone quarry, and they left that quarry essentially there so it could continue to flood during a storm, and then it's a recreation area afterwards. So it's just a lot of working with what already exists in nature, letting things flood where possible, and not building, you know, not trying to control or, as Gary said, manage water as much as we do. And there's really great examples from all over the world. One of the leading examples of ways that we do this in an urban environment is in Seoul, South Korea, the Cheongjaecheong River. In the 1970s, they put it underground, essentially put it in a cement box and built a 6-lane highway over the top. It's pretty bad. And then in 2003, the mayor of the city decided that they wanted to kind of revive the river, get rid of the highway, and they proceeded, and they essentially tore down the highway and brought that river back up to the surface. And it's still not 100% natural environment, but it does a great job channeling floodwater. It's a huge centerpiece for the city. It's a tourist attraction, but also a gathering point, place for festivals. And so it's one of those things where if we start to build more sponge city concept into cities, it not just makes it more resilient, but it makes it a nicer place to live as well.
Is there any other example that you can think of where people have integrated sponge city ideas that make sense and that have worked?
Yeah, I mean, we go back a few years and Berlin had catastrophic flooding. And they spent a lot of time since then building some stormwater catchment that uses more natural integration in the city. So big reservoirs and kind of lakes that capture water, reducing their reliance on pipes. Jakarta, Indonesia, suffers a lot from monsoon flooding. So they get a huge rainy season, plus they're dealing with soil subsistence. So the city itself is actually sinking. So they have a strange relationship or a rough relationship with water as it is, but they've worked hard on building more of these bunch of these concepts into the city as well. Singapore is kind of leading the way as well. And then again, where sponge cities originated in China, there's over 200 cities that are starting to build sponge city concepts. Wuhan is one of the leaders in that, but Shanghai is also doing it as well. And so there's just a a lot of work being done, and it's mostly in cities that have had either catastrophic flooding at one point or have this relationship with a really rainy season, and they know it's only going to get worse over time, and they might as well do it now rather than, you know, kick the ball and wait longer.
Gary Brierley, over to you.
I just think it's fascinating to reflect on parallels in the ways that thinking is shifting. If I move into the bigger picture rivers space, rather than specifically focusing in urban environments, the principles and ethos that we're moving towards of nature-based solutions are very, very similar. It's kind of like a conservation-first ethos. If you've got bits that are working well, look after them. Identify what those bits are. If you've got bits of river systems that have got space to adjust where water can be stored, allow those bits of the system to function in that kind of way. I think that the conservation first ethos definitely works. And then it's kind of like, well, how do we frame recovery programs? What does that mean? What does that look like? And across the world, there's a move towards natural flood management programs. And there are key principles that underpin that. The first one is catchment scale, watershed scale planning, where you manage at source and at scale. And you recognize that the issues at the bottom ends of catchments are largely products of what happens upstream. And so there's massive issues of equity and social and environmental justice in the ways that we frame these kinds of applications. But shifting the mentality towards one of bigger picture thinking about the ways that water is moving through systems, thinking about, for example, how deforestation in certain systems has changed the flow and sediment budgets and how we've got legacy effects from that, but what the benefits could be of reforesting certain areas or targeted interventions that do that. And how these kind of relationships play out for different river systems. There's quite a nice language that's emerging of understanding the story of the river, understanding how each river system works. And if you understand it's the story of that river, then you've got a sense of what targeted event interventions can look like for that particular system. Recognizing that one of the best interventions we've got is to promote self-healing, to let the river look after itself as far as practicable. But then there are other instances where we need to give the river more space. We need to work out what is possible where in giving the river back the space that the river sees as its land already. When you look across Aotearoa, you can see very different opportunities for that in different contexts. But this space to move intervention, this freedom space or erodible corridor thinking, again, is global in terms of its scope. There's amazing sets of activities that have taken place in Europe and in North America in relation to these kinds of practices. And this kind of thinking is already well embedded in across various parts of Asia. And we have to seriously think about what this looks like in a New Zealand context, right?
One of the things that you have noted in your some of your writing is that nature-based solutions really need to be examined through an indigenous lens, because if you do then introduce species, it can also do damage.
100%. Not speaking on behalf of others, but working and collaborating with colleagues for whom I have immense respect in this space. I think that we need to embrace a different way of thinking and working with colleagues such as Dan Hikaroa and with Anne Salmond and Billy Lithberg from Business and Maori Studies.
But also in terms of the indigenous species.
Again, got to be very, very careful, right, in terms of how we conceptualize these things and what works well where, because there are definitely instances where if we want to act quickly, then exotics provide a mechanism to do that. And there's massive controversy in things like natural sequence farming in Australia over the use of exotic species. And there's various major scale river restoration, river rehabilitation projects in China that are using plants that come out of Mexico. And I think we've got to be really, everything is contextual. That's the one thing that I would say, right? And I think that there are times when we can't afford to be too precious because the issues that we've got to address need attention now. And so we've got to look at these things over an array of different timescales and not just hone in on notional quick fixes, but some stages, in some instances, that is what we need.
All right, let's kind of finalize with the politics and policy of all this. Like, what does it take policy-wise and politically to advance these types of things? And has that been difficult? Tim Welch, you first.
The direction we want to go in the future politically has put ourselves at odds with kind of implementing these more nature-based solutions. So our current trajectory is, again, to build out our cities to continue to pave over green space and wetlands, putting people at risk, our cities at risk, and again, to build out and not up. And we have historically densified in a way that's also made ourselves more vulnerable over time. And this gets back to politics in a minute here, but we have swallowed up kind of backyards and trees and things like that that also help mitigate floods in order to kind of build more single family housing. And what we really need to do is build ourselves more vertically. So rain doesn't have a problem with us going vertical. It's the same roof space, no matter how many stories you have, essentially. And so that's one way in which we can start to combat in the future through policy some of the risk to flooding and be more sustainable as a city, is to continue to grow upwards rather than outwards. So that's a big component of it. Things like car parks could be reduced and could be using more permeable surfaces if we build that into our policy. As we redevelop road space, we could build into our policy that instead of just like-for-like replacement, you know, repaving a road, we can build in more materials and more things like bioswales that help us collect rainwater and channel it more appropriately, rely less on pipes. So there's all kinds of things that we can do politically through policy that don't require significantly more funding than we're already facing in upgrading the existing systems. But it requires the kind of political willpower to do that. And at this stage, we just don't have that leadership politically right now. We're focused on building as quickly as we can, as much as we can, as far out as we can. And so we're really just setting ourselves up for more problems down the road.
Last word, Gary Brierley.
Unfortunately, I agree completely with that set of comments from Tim there. I think that there's an enormous disconnect between the practitioners, the people who are working in agencies and councils and consulting groups and CRIs, in the sense of what they want to be doing relative to what policy is allowing them to do. And there is this tragic disconnect. The situation is bordering on woeful at the moment in the ways in which some of these things are moving forward. There's a positive side to that. The people are available who can bring about transformative practice. And there's a very large number of individuals in those various bodies and organizations who can pull together to enact change in different kinds of ways. And I've got a kind of a playful way of dealing with this at the moment. My big mantra at the moment, I'm pushing for CORPS, C-O-R-P-S, communities of river practitioners. Ways of working together towards better futures. And it's a play on language there, because it's a bit of a critique on the Corps of Engineers that created the silenced and strangled rivers that we're dealing with. So I see our future very much as a collective, community-focused set of outcomes that moves beyond the singular focus on a development ethos that is just making the same mistakes that we've been making recurrently.
Thank you so much to our guests, Gary Brierley and Tim Welch, both of the University of Auckland.
When we come back, agricultural workers are seizing their land back from industry. We explore one of those cases. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What does the land back movement mean for social justice and environmental protection? We examine the case of repossession of land in Indonesia.
I'm Doug Becker. Before we start this segment, I'd like to apologize for the sound issues. We were recording online and our guest was overseas. The connection was not all that strong. But even though many words were cut off, the context of the conversation will help you understand what our guest is saying. We thank you for your understanding. Throughout modern history, many agricultural workers have found themselves dispossessed of the land where they work. That sentence is in passive voice for a reason. because the analysis often removes the agency from those literally seizing the land from the workers that they once owned and worked. Industrial agricultural corporations have seized this land, and the workers are compelled to work in difficult and often exploitative conditions. But the workers are fighting back. On today's show, we will explore one specific campaign, the Cassiavera campaign in Indonesia. In this campaign, the linkage between worker repossession of the land, and it's a physical repossession of the land, not necessarily legal, this worker repossession of the land is closely tied to environmental protections against land degradation and is as well a campaign to achieve social as well as environmental justice. Our guest today has written a new book on this issue. The book is called Countering Dispossession, Reclaiming Land, and the author is David Gilbert. David Gilbert is an anthropologist, a postdoctoral researcher in society and environment at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's active in protest movements across three continents. David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for your interest.
So the Cassiavera campaign, tell us a bit what was behind the campaign, what actually happened in this campaign as workers repossessed land.
In the face of great oppression, Cassiavera's laborers and smallholder farmers found a way to gain access to land that was taken from them generations before. What was first a logging concession, plantation, mostly for ginger and tobacco, workers became activists, and they were able to occupy the land, dismantle a company's offices and barracks, and blockade the road up to the plantation. When company ownership returned with the Indonesian army to try and get it back, reclaimers held fast. And after years of back and forth and conflict, reclaimers were able to hold on to this land and eventually found a certain peace and space to experiment on it in what I and other scholars call alternative economies or a solidarity economy, where they cultivated a food forest using agroforestry, growing fruit trees, mostly timber trees, crops like avocado, durian, really valuable timber species like mahogany. They were able to manage it themselves collectively on what they actually have come to call their collective land, with an alliance between an Indonesian peasant union and a local governing council. And places like this, you know, we call autonomous zones, or some people call them squats, or commons, or maybe better yet, communes. And these places are the way that we can understand how to go beyond capitalism and the climate crisis that's threatening us, where, you know, once a place that was dominated by violent overseers on the plantation and deforestation across that land, and men and women laboring as what they called themselves to be coolies, planting and picking and spraying pesticides from backpack sprayers. You know, this reclaiming all of these ills of industrial plantation agriculture to an end. And where once a military general turned plantation owner basically was the sole beneficiary of the land, now like a bit more than 200 families use it as a basis for their well-being. The transformation on the land has been quite remarkable. Walking through it, parts of it now have a closed look to be a natural rainforest, but in fact, it's planted, as I mentioned, and it's come alive, like with the sights and sounds and smells of a thriving tropical cloud forest.
To circle back a little bit to the details of this, first of all, when did this movement, this, you know, reclaiming movement take place? What were the years when it started and when it was completed?
The peasant people that have been living in Cassiavera have suffered many, many moments of dispossession in their history. First under the Dutch colonialists that dominated Indonesia as a whole, and in Cassiavera's on the island of Sumatra. First, you know, in around the early 1900s, they were pushed off the land, and then they got it back kind of at the end of Dutch colonial control. And then there was the rise of most violent and oppressive military dictatorships, what's known as the Indonesia's New Order regime, run by a major general named Suharto. And there is like the kind of moment of dispossession people that still live on the land were most concerned with undoing. It was 1968 or so when the New Order took control of the country in a violent genocide against leftists and of all kinds, indigenous people, LGBTQ people, artists. And with this kind of pogrom, this mass violence, many people lost their land. And many people for decades suffered under these enclosures and dispossessions. And over about two or three decades, almost 30 years, slowly the New Order kind of began to crack and a movement started to unfold. And Cassiavera was one of the key places in this archipelago-wide reclaiming movement. So it was kind of mid-1990s, people first started to reclaim the land. This was quite a bold step for them to take. I mean, going up against one of the most terrifying combinations of like illegitimate power, the authoritarian dictatorship and a rapacious corporate agriculture company, or agribusiness, as we call it, started kind of underground organizing, just talking amongst each other. And once they felt like they had a group of about 200 committed people, mostly laborers on the plantation, also some smallholder folk that lived nearby, they started to kind of go up to the edges of the plantation, kind of places that weren't used. And they started to cultivate it for things like vegetable crops or grass to feed. And then as they saw there wasn't much of a response from the company, they started to occupy more and more of the plantation, and what eventually culminated in the events I mentioned with the destruction of the barracks and the blockade of the main road that went up to it. And this was kind of almost like a 6 or 7 year long back and forth that was supported by, at the time, what was called the West Sumatra. That's now become part of the Indonesian Peasant Union. It's one of the largest unions of its type in Indonesia with almost a million members. They also work quite closely with a local customary or indigenous council that existed. And those forms of customary leadership and the activists were doing their forms of direct action. These leaders were leading a letter writing campaign to the government to try to justify why they should have legal right to the land back.
This campaign, though you mentioned writing letters and making legal cases, this really is the campaign of political action, you know, the workers seizing the land themselves as opposed to being filing cases, you know, through the courts. And really strikes me, involves a great deal of incredible bravery on the part of the workers themselves in light of threats, right?
Absolutely. You know, one of the women most involved with the reclamation movement and the blockades of the plantation told me she used a very specific Indonesian word, nekat, which is kind of brings a connotation of recklessness, not even being afraid of death. For people that are living under this impossible death from their own lands, generations or decades can go by, and those harms, if not ameliorated, only grow. And you know, life as a plantation laborer was not sufficient for people that were living nearby and knew that they were the rightful owners of this land, and they were willing to take these risks. You know, they were also were acting with the support of some really influential leaders in their area, and they worked really hard to bring politicians over to their side. And it wasn't until that they felt like they had some of that support were they ready to take the boldest action. So, you know, I think that this bringing together of direct action while also being willing to work with people that maybe from the outset aren't perceived as like friendly, but really working hard to bring them over to their side to sympathize. You know, one of the most fascinating questions for me is why wasn't Cassiavera's reclamation crushed like so many others were? In years of research, I actually came across a letter that was written by a military intelligence officer. And, you know, this military intelligence was one of the most feared parts of the New Order dictatorship, because basically they were the ones that were responsible for disappearing untold numbers of activists and politicians for murders, for kidnapping, torture. But the Cassiveres Reclaimers were actually able to convince one of the military officers to write a letter in support of their cause. It just so happened that this military officer was born very nearby and sympathized with the indigenous nationality there, the Minangkabau person. So we see this bringing together this almost magic formula of direct action, formal legal policy work, like this letter writing campaign, and then, you know, of actually making something of the land itself, making it useful and economically productive. You know, bringing all these things together, I think, was really one of the ways that Cassiovera was able to survive, while as many other sites of land occupation successful.
You said this is taking place in the 90s. I know Indonesia, by the end of the decade, this new order, you know, government that you've been describing eventually gets replaced by a more democratic, at least quasi-democratic, you know, governance. I'm a political scientist, and so the causation question is going to be a bit of a challenge, but there's definitely the success of this movement, success of these types of movements, and leading Indonesia to a less repressive government and a more democratic government. Do the timeframes line up for, you know, things like the success in Cassiovera and this transition eventually to a less repressive government in Indonesia?
Absolutely. You know, the changes that reclaimers in Cassiovera and other Java in particular, those two islands had a very strong reclaiming movement right at the end of the new order. You know, it showed people that, you know, the changes in livelihood and in ecology and environment of the places where these reclamation movements were allowed to consolidate, you know, these places became like wellsprings of liberation from the oppression, not only from the government, but also from the plantation economy that continues to be so fundamental to the Indonesian state. And so how these forms of cooperation and activism, these networks became part of a larger movement that actually brought down Suharto. Many of the same individual players, activists, were involved in both the protest movement that brought down Suharto and also this land reclaiming movement. It goes beyond just that protest. It showed people what's possible in an economy that's based on greater cooperation and less oppression. It showed people what's possible in terms of property politics and forms of organization and representation. And so these movements went hand in hand, but we can't overstate, you know, what's happened in Indonesia. The vital importance of the freedom that the new democratic government brought to over 200 million people that live in Indonesia was much needed. And it brought a great reduction in violence and a great increase in people's freedom of expression in particular. But it also brought an acceleration of these plantation agricultures, albeit in, you know, a less overtly violent form, but violence continues in Indonesia's plantation lands. And the expansion over the last two decades since the democratic era happened was faster than in the two decades during the military regime. And so, you know, there's much work to be done. That's one of the reasons why I think Cassiovera's story is so important. It offers people inspiration and hope, not only in Indonesia, but across the world where plantation economies are quite dominant. And of course, the products that are produced in these places are being shipped to many places in the north. So as consumers, we're tied up to the fate of these places. And the belief that democracy can always free people from this type of oppression, we clearly see that that's not the case in Indonesia and other places where this form of economy still really predominates.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about a land repossession movement, one specifically in Cassiovera in Indonesia, of a new book called Countering Disposition, Reclaiming Land, and the author is David Gilbert's. David, also, we've been speaking a lot about questions, economic justice, social justice, and that in and of itself is a compelling reason to support these types of movements. But actually, positive outcomes extend beyond just the social justice of economic empowerment. You made some references about the way in which the farm itself is operated differently, a different sort of stewardship that's definitely seems to be greener, more concerned with questions of environmental degradation. In what ways are these Cassia Vera itself and these areas that are repossessed by workers just cared for with a greater concern for sustainability, a greater concern for the environment?
Yeah, of course. Creation of lands itself is no guarantee that we'll see environmental benefits. But in this case, in Cassia Vera, we've seen this incredible transformation of the landscape. You know, where before under the plantation, there were single rows of just one or maybe two crops that were being planted in exposed soils using pesticides. These places are huge emitters of climate changing carbon dioxide. They're huge emitters of toxic chemicals. They're huge drivers of deforestation across the world. And in place of these problems in Cassia Vera, the reclaimers created a smallholder landscape, and they cultivated agricultural forests on it, what people there called parak, or Western scientists especially call agroforests, or what I like to call food forests. These are forests that are planted for their economic value, but they're thriving, ecologically sound tropical rainforests. Dominant tree crops include avocado, cinnamon, clove, durian, orange trees. And these agroforests are really significant for their diversity. That's far greater than that of the industrial monoculture plantations that now cover, you know, hundreds of thousands of square miles across Indonesia. And these are really intimate human interactions with these forests, grown entirely without toxic chemicals. And they're the basis of these livelihoods that are sending people's children in Cassia Vera to university. They made the landscape healthier and the people working there healthier. And this growing forest, this still emerging forest, makes up a watershed in a way that the industrial plantations don't, completing, you know, Sumatra's really complex and important water cycles. And these cycles allow the agroforest to take up carbon out of the atmosphere, effectively cooling down the planet, where in contrast, you know, the industrial agriculture as a whole is the second largest emitter of carbon dioxide and other climate changing gases, only after the energy sector. So in these ways, you know, agroforestry, when done in this way, when carried out the way Cassia Vera did, really takes like a threefold importance as it relates to nature, biodiversity, and global climate cycles and smallholder food production.
So I think the argument that you're making from an anthropological perspective, that I know that in the political world, there's a social, political, and environmental, a complex web, these sort of three areas of sustainability. So specifically, it seems fair to say that when the land is owned more in common, where the workers own the land, are better stewards of the land than, say, industrial agriculture and this drive towards the centralization of agriculture. It seems like there's an important statement about capitalism, about self-empowerment and questions of sustainability in this. I guess my question is, would you agree from your observations in this case that these really are inexorably intertwined?
Oh, these webs are so fundamental. We need to perceive life going forward on our planet if we are going to have life at all. And it makes so much sense that if the people who are experiencing the landscape on a lived daily kind of mundane level, if they're empowered to make the decisions about what type of landscape it'll be, what type of conditions that they're going to be laboring under or with every day. If their primary motive isn't only the accumulation of profits, but of a life well lived. You know, I think these things feel really just basic and obvious to people. And of course, You know, the challenge isn't so much understanding why having that type of autonomy or power to decide how and where and under what conditions we would work with the environment. The real challenge is how to understand, move beyond the system of capitalist agribusiness that's consolidated now over the last 200 years and includes, you know, some of the world's most powerful corporations and lobbyists. And in Indonesia alone, logging and plantation and mining companies control some like 15 million hectares of land, which is like almost the size of one quarter of California. Indonesia is quite a large country, but it's a series of island nations. I mean, this is a huge amount of land. And there's a project called the Land Matrix Research Project that's trying to record how much land is under corporate control. And their estimate right now around the world, something like three times the size of Germany is under corporate control, land itself. And of course, Germany is one of the world's largest economies. So corporations having quite an undue influence in the way that people are allowed to relate to the land. And in Indonesia, just as it happened in the United States, it was actually the state-directed handover of land to corporations that allowed the system to consolidate around, you know, 1900 to the pre-World War II era. And so it's been going on, you know, for so long about how strange this system is. And, you know, part of my work is in the work of Cassiveres activists and the work of La Via Campesina, an umbrella group of smallholder and peasant people across the world that represents over 20 million people across some 30 nations, is to help us imagine how to do things differently on the land. And, you know, what we see so clearly in Cassiveres is when together to allow people to reimagine our connections with the land, how to live with it, how to be more influenced by existing indigenous perspectives and existing smallholder farmer perspectives, the great wealth that can be created from the land without damaging it in a way that industrial agriculture does.
Cassiveres seems certainly part of this movement, but this is about much more than just Indonesia. There's this move globally for groups that are seeking to reseize land. Have you seen in the land back movement, and for those of us who find a real inspiration in this, what kind of support can we provide?
Land back movements include millions of indigenous peoples and agriculturalists and urban activists like across the world. And, you know, foremost, we need to acknowledge that the land back movement is an indigenous-led collection of movements. One of really has originated and is at its strongest is in Canada and in the Midwest of the USA, where First Nation peoples and other indigenous organization members have refused to live under this impossible condition of being dispossessed from their own homelands. And have organized from the moment that white colonists arrived to these places, have been willing to get their land back. And, you know, we can't think of these as separate struggles, less so now than ever, with, you know, the great challenges that capitalism is placing to all of us. Here in California, where I'm from, there's a group called the Segurite Land Trust that's been working within the so-called United States legal framework for housing and for urban farming and sacred natural sites or sacred natural spaces with really incredible success over the last few years. Also a little bit further north of the California Bay Area in Humboldt County, the Wiat peoples have similarly reclaimed control of their territories, parts of their territories through legal rights, mostly from the local government. And these are just like two of what's this now Pan-American collection of strategies of dissent and protests, and also working with the existing legal system to get land back. Segurite asks for white settlers to pay a land tax, as I do, what they call shumi, on Ohlone indigenous territory in California Bay Area. So that's one way that we can support their movement. You know, other people have taken the step of even giving parcels of land across the Bay Area back to Segurite Land Trust to support land back. And, you know, as this movement continues to expand, it's been bringing in Latinx and solidarity white settler communities. And it's creating a way of existing that doesn't depend on this like endless capitalist exploitation of the land and alienation from it. I'd like to think that like an organization like Feed'em Freedom, which was founded by Black Panthers in Detroit, and that now includes like hundreds of guerrilla gardens, as they call it, you know, underground urban gardens, like think of them as reclaimers too, because they're joining these ideas of like social mobilization and agriculture and new forms of reparations and control of the land to sustain like their political aspirations. So, you know, this isn't a large domain of academic study. We don't really understand how many places like this are out there in the world, but my sense is there's a lot more than we would think. My sense is that these places that are engulfed by colonial and corporate dispossession, that they're hungry for movements like this and they're going to continue to grow. And, you know, I think that beyond sending money, that engagement, that activism, that willingness to get involved with direct action protests to challenge the status quo of this, you know, corporate police and military complex that's controlling the land across the planet, like all of it is needed by all of us.
The book is called Countering Dispossession, Reclaiming Land. The author is David Gilbert. David Gilbert is an anthropologist and a postdoctoral researcher in society and environment at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's active in protest movements across three continents. David, thank you very much for joining us, for sharing your insight and your research in this really wonderful book, and I encourage all of our listeners to pick it up.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.